Welcome to the new people that are here today. And one doesn't really try to catch up. One gets to have the experience one's having because one's arrived where one's arrived. And that's really the wise orientation. Otherwise, you distract yourself from the immediacy of your own experience. I've tried that a number of times. That's why I now know better. So I wanted to, yesterday, I was being inspiring in a kind of fierce way. So I wanted to do, a couple of things. Just, I wanted to read a little poem to start with before we even sit that, it's moving it away from just dukkha. And this is from a poem by Jack Gilbert, G-I-L-B-E-R-T, Gilbert. And it's an excerpt from A Brief for the Defense. If we deny our happiness, resist our satisfaction, we lessen the importance of their deprivation. We must risk delight. Repeating, we must risk delight. We can do without pleasure, but not delight, not enjoyment. We must have the stubbornness to accept our gladness in the ruthless furnace of this world. To make injustice the only measure of our attention is to praise the devil. So I am very much oriented to the dukkha in my own practice and all, but I really totally subscribe to this. That we must risk delight, and there's a very personal version of that for you and whatever circumstance you're in, where like there's maybe not but brief moments of delight, or there may be a lot of delight, or your relationship is going through a very difficult time, and you're seeing how things end and. But under any and all circumstance, as best we're able, my key phrase that on the tombstone, we must risk delight. We must risk delight. So continue our exploration today. We will be doing the third noble truth and the fourth noble truth, and we are going to continue the exploration yesterday we did the awareness of the body, the four foundations of mindfulness, sometimes called the four establishments of mindfulness, meaning, where is mindfulness established? It's established first in the body, and the Buddha gave more instructions for how to establish it in the body than anywhere else. And then we did mindfulness, the second of the Satipatthanas, the four establishments. The second one is becoming habitually aware, just as a default, aware of the presence of the flavoring of moment of a pleasant and unpleasant, and neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So we did that because that, again, body is what keeps us here in the immediate, and the pleasant and unpleasant have such a conditioning effect on the moment and future moments. And if we don't notice it, we really get controlled by it, and we can also start having a strategy to just the strategies based on pleasure and avoiding non-pleasure, and that is not a very long, sustainable kind of satisfactory way to live. And as you've noticed in the poem, he said, "We can do without pleasure, but not delight," and that's why I particularly was happy to get to read that to you this morning. So pleasure is just pleasure. Delight has something to do with much more how you're choosing to be. Delight can be much more of an internal controlled situation than pleasure. Pleasure is based on a lot of conditions, but delight is just where you're standing, what you notice, and you're standing there. You have, wherever we always have a perspective, as I said yesterday. We're standing somewhere, and then in such a place that we can see the delight, and all sorts of things. And that's a little clue in life. You know, it's a little kind of one of these open secret things about knowing that difference and figuring that out for yourself. So let it stand as a clue for today. Maybe another visit we'll go into it as a group examination. And so today, in this first meditation, we're going to be looking at the mind states that arise. This is the third satipatthana, the third establishment of mindfulness, third way that we want to put the four satipatthanas of the establishments of mindfulness, take our experience and divide it as body, pleasant and unpleasant, as vedana, and then the noticing the mind states, which includes the emotional component of the mind state, and then the fourth is seeing it from dharma eyes, dharma experience. And so we get the body's the most accessible, keeps us here. This pleasant, unpleasant, we start to get some space around our experience. Then we're able to see our mind states, including noticing their pleasant and unpleasantness. And then we start to learn to be able to see our experience, to literally experience our experience with from a Dharma point of view. So we're seeing our experience through Dharma eyes. So we notice if the mind has hindrances in it and so forth, and or if there's these awakening factors are present. And we notice what makes up a moment, that there's these five aggregates that make up a moment and so forth. And that's what's in the fourth establishment of mindfulness, that fourth satipatthana. And at the very end, so it's progressive, that fourth satipatthana, and at the very end of it, the very last thing that you, in a mature way, a maturing understanding, realize is the Four Noble Truths. So you start way back here with just noticing standing, sitting, walking, all of this, and then you, this arc of practice, and at the end, you're able to not just intellectually know, but realize the 12 insights of the Four Noble Truths. It's such a beautiful structure, you know, and we're doing it all at once. But we know where we're going, and we're not in a big hurry to get there, because we understand where we're going and how long will it take? As long as it takes. So we can't rush it along. We can have more. We can make having practice opportunities a larger priority in our lives, but we can't rush along our development. But we can create better conditions for learning and developing. But that's all. But then it will take just as long as it takes, and it really, you know, again, it's not like a fair allocation. Like each of us have to take each of us the same amount of time. You know, and the Buddha talks about these four kind of learners. That there's, let's see if I can do this from memory now. So, like with the fast horse, it's a fast horse, and it doesn't need any prodding, but it's a fast horse that needs prodding, or it's a slow horse but it doesn't need any prodding, or it's a slow horse that needs prodding. I identify with the slow horse that needs prodding. And that kind of, our nature is just our nature. And we actually don't want to complain about our nature, but rather we would rather be amused by it and take a kind of delight in, wow, boy, this is one to work with. And each of those have their own problems. Fast horses, as you know, can get in all sorts of trouble. And some of you are probably fast horses in this room. And you know what I mean by that. And so forth. So there's an order to Buddha Dhamma. There's an order. There's a developmental cycle. But it is in the experience itself. The other thing I'll say before we start is to catch everybody up. Well, is that Now I'm conflicted between two things here. So we're learning to recognize the arising of dukkha, that when we're in that. So we spent a lot of time yesterday and Friday night with this recognition, and I read a quote. In between knowing something and refusing to know it lies a murky chasm that even the most enlightened among us are perfectly happy to inhabit. In between knowing something and refusing to know it lies a murky chasm that even the most enlightened among us are perfectly happy to inhabit. And we talked about these three gaps or three chasms. One is that we know something is dukkha, but we don't know it. Well, you know, but we already know it, but we don't know it. So why not? That's a gap. Why is that true? So, like, again, I kept using eating late at night as an example, because that's sort of anybody of any body size or type can do that, and it does affect sleep for a lot of people. So, so that we can literally know. As we're opening the refrigerator door, or if your habits to drink late at night or something, that's even more pronounced that you know. But one goes ahead anyway, because one doesn't actually experience the knowing of the dukkha. Even though one knows the dukkha, there's some like, what is that? What's that space? And we're learning to close that space by a shift in attitude and a shift in perspective. So that's the first of these chasms. The second is that, okay, now we know it, but we don't realize, oh, but I really have a choice here. I genuinely have a choice. I do not actually have to go ahead and open that refrigerator door or uncork that bottle or whatever it is. I really do have a choice. Somehow we know that we see ourselves, and but we don't yet know somehow, and we have a choice. And that's in a way even a more mysterious gap, because like if we are present, that we know, oh yeah, this is really a bad idea, why would we not think at least to ask, well, do I have any choice? And that is how I am suggesting to close the gap, is by asking, do I have any choice here? And because we don't always have choice. Sometimes we're too far gone. We're hell bent on doing this. We're going to tell this person how upset we are with them, even though it's going to turn into a big mess. And there's nothing. We do not have any choice inside. We've gotten so identified with, in Buddhist language, taken birth in the person who feels the injustice of this, and we're going to tell them, even though it's going to create a bigger mess for us. And what we should do is stay out of that entanglement. We get more entangled. The Buddha liked to talk about how entangled human beings get. So we're going to get more entangled. But we don't know that's true unless we ask, do I have any choice here? Do I have a choice? You would think that wouldn't be that hard to do. That's very hard to do in a lot of situations in your life. It's really hard to do. And now in certain things, like I love it when couples have learned to deal with each other's ways that get on their nerves, where they like, instead of the one person does something that's clumsy, and the other one starts to respond, but then they realize they have a choice, and you can watch them like swerve around it or something, or you watch it happen in the face and all this. I consider that great coupledom when people can really do that with each other. Sometimes it's one-sided, and that's not so attractive, but it's better one-sided than, you know, one-sided is enough to avoid the, right? And then, so that's what I mean by choice, but in the gap to where we don't realize we have a choice. And I'm not saying you always have a choice. I want to repeat this, because it's not a question of blaming yourself. It's a question, is there a choice? Because we're always in the, as best I am able, state. But we are capable. of training ourselves to ask, do I have a choice here? Do I have a choice? And we do it by taking little small things in our lives. So we're complaining about the traffic. I used that example yesterday. Or there's this person that's sort of a mild irritant, you know, but they're not really upsetting to us, but they just kind of like, there they go again, you know, kind of things. But do I have to go down that path of commenting that way? Is there any other choice? Like, oh, he's caught again. Or, oh, she's in her needy state, you know. Like just, oh. So moving from this kind of judging mind to a compassion mind. So, but is there a choice of doing that? If you're in a bad mood already, you won't even think about it. You know, just one more little unpleasant moment. But if the more you make it a habit, the more you train the mind that this is what you want, that you want these thoughts to arise, these thoughts will arise more. You will notice what your energy follows attention. And so as you've learned to place your attention over and over again, it starts being energetic for you. And then your psyche kind of goes, oh, she really cares about this. And so psyche then starts doing it for you, so you don't have to kind of go through the steps. You just kind of feel, oh, there's a choice here. So you don't have all of the cognitive thoughts any longer. You just kind of become a kinder person, a wiser person. Because we would never get there if we have to go through all of these reflections over and over again. And so much of our life, our psyche runs for us anyway, you know, that we just do all these things automatically. And so then the third gap is when we've said, oh yeah, I do have a choice here, and we really recognize the better choice, but the actual intention falls into the chasm. Like, why did I do that? I actually knew the better thing to do. I mean, I knew it. There's no question. I knew it in a felt sense way, and still. That's this third chasm that we fall into. That is particularly mysterious in that you would think that even this ego personality could look out for its own best interest at that level. But our habits are so much larger because our personality formations are... So the ego, using the language of the ego's executive functioning that can remember and do associative thinking and make decisions, plan, that kind of thing, that we have these personality formations that are in us that are varying degrees of independence from the ego's control in that way. So for many conditioned reasons and so that just happens that way, but we can learn to by this using our mindfulness, we can more and more have fewer of those places where we know that we have a choice and not make it. We learn more and more to make that shift. So we recognize suffering, we realize we have a choice, and then we resolve and act. You know, we resolve and we choose different. And that is the right, those three would be describing the right effort part of the Eightfold Path. Right effort is moving attention towards that which is wholesome. If it's on something wholesome, you stay with it. If it's moving towards something unwholesome, you divert. If it's in something unwholesome, you get out of dodge in a reasonable way that you can. Those are the four teachings around right effort in the Eightfold Path. So I'm taking that right effort and giving a different way to slice it to see if that makes it more actionable. You know, I'm very practical about this, and so I'm breaking it down in an actionable way that people can imagine. So I think everybody in the room could recognize those three gaps in their own history of choice. And so that's the value of that. Let me see if there's anything else that I did that. There's maybe something else that I'll remember as we're going through, but right now I don't. So let us, we're going to be doing this, we're going to, well, we're going to be arriving in the room, which is an orientation to making, to helping us come into the immediacy of the situation mindfully, but mindful with intention. So we need mindfulness and intention in relation to live a conscious life, an intentional life. And so we're going to do that again, and then you'll be asked to do that on your own for the rest of the day, because I'm really wanting you to make your version of that that will help you in life. And then we'll go through, we'll go to the body, then we'll go to pleasant and unpleasant, and then we'll go to these emotional mind states. Bring your attention to the here, to the now. Arriving in the moment, knowing that your goal is to arrive in the moment, and that you have this intention, moment to moment, to be in that very moment. So this is like a double reward, a double effort that one's twice inspired. The idea contained in the goal that, yes, I want to be present in the moments of my life. That's an idea. And then the intention is this very moment. Even if it's an unpleasant moment, I would rather be present for it than not. Maybe with a few exceptions, but so filling the space in the room where we are here, here in this space, on this campus, in this building, in this room. And the room feels like this, in temperature, in sound, in the quality of the air, the feeling of the rest of us around you. Here now. Here in this space, now in this moment. And likewise, arriving with our aspirations. We are here to learn, to grow, to practice in whatever form it's taking for you. It might be just to have less stress, or to find emotional comfort, or more liberation oriented in a longer term. Just the knowing that you're here aspirationally, and you've given yourself this opportunity. You have said to yourself, there's a choice today, and this is what I choose. So respect yourself for the choice you've made by acknowledging it and honoring that this is your values. And then the intention of the moment to moment in the day. And having mindfulness come front and center. So you know you're going to utilize this mindfulness of the Buddha. The mindfulness of the Buddha is part of the Eightfold Path also, and doesn't really work as the Buddha's mindfulness without that context. So mindfulness is front and center. And with this this kind of momentum of funneling your thoughts, your heart space, your body space, you're funneling funneling everything into this very moment of here and now. We turn to the body. We become mindful of the body, not judging the body, not comparing the body, not fixing the body. So easy to judge. So easy to compare. So easy to think, oh, I can, or if I could, if only. We are taking things as they are. The body feels like this. You may feel the body as a whole presence, so there's not so much detail of sensation, but an overall affect of body. Or you may feel the body as a number of sensations that are ever-changing. In the first Satipatthana, there's all these different ways of the four postures, the body and its parts, the 32 parts of the body. Or the body as the elements, which we did yesterday. But today, the body is like this. Let the earth element in the body relax. Trust that Mother Earth will receive it. As you do this, you may feel the breath more predominant, or it may suddenly arise, or it may be a more full breath, or there be no change at all. And then, just with the exhale of the breath, let a wave of relaxation pass from the top of the skull into the face, the back of the skull, the throat, the back of the neck, down the shoulders into the arms, upper, lower hands, pass down the back, all the spine relaxing, letting the chest relax, the upper abdomen relax, lower abdomen, all the organs inside the cavity. Relaxed, relaxed, relaxed. Letting the organs in the pelvic bowl relax as that pelvic bowl just sits through the chair, the bench, the cushion, to earth. Again, there can be quite a affect to this kind of relaxing, or none at all. Relaxing all around the pubic bone and down into the thighs, both the internal and the external. Sometimes this deepens the breath. And now the upper legs relaxing. The knees and lower legs relaxing, the ankles and feet, toes relaxing. And now notice the breath. Start to turn your attention, pour your attention onto the breath. Turning your attention may change the breath. Don't fight that change. If you see you're starting to control the breath, deliberately control it for a moment and then stop, rather than trying to just stop instantly. Turn it back into the voluntary nervous system and then let it loose. Presence. Being mindful leads us to be present. This feeling of being present matures into a feeling of presence, that we have presence. Just invite that with this breath, that you're present for the breath. You're a participant witness here and now, not as an identity, but as an experience, repeating, not as an identity, a me and a mine, but rather as an experience. Here now. So satisfying. With the breath, but utilizing the breath wisely. Gentle attention, so the mind's not touching the breath harshly, but rather just allowing the knowing to arise as the breath breathes us. The breath breathes you here, now. This participant observer, you know the taste of the breath, and yet you know there is breathing. Anchoring ourselves in the breath-body experience, breath being invited to be in the foreground, but at times the body may come in the foreground as body sensations. Not trying to control that so much, but knowing that the breath is our anchor, if it works for you to have the breath, it may not. In that case, let the body be the anchor. And now start to notice with the inhale whether the experience has a little touch of pleasant or a little touch of unpleasant or a little flavoring that's kind of neutral, that's bland. Sometimes, as we start to open to this second foundation of mindfulness, of pleasant and unpleasant, it gets our attention in such a way that the mind becomes more still, more open. Throughout this meditation, notice if anything does that for you. And now notice with the exhale, pleasant or unpleasant or neither. You may be in close with the breath and notice the beginning of the inhale, its duration, its ending. Or you may be further away, again, just feeling the breath as pulsation or vibration, as tingling, as a wave-like motion, as an expansion and contracting, a rise and a falling in terms of its effect on the body. Now start to notice when the mind is pulled away to thinking, planning, being creative, commenting on our experience, evaluating it, judging it, comparing it, fixing it. When the mind is pulled away from the breath-body experience, what has that strength to pull it away? Just for today, just for this sit, knowing this as best as one is able. Now start to notice the mind state that pulls you away. Notice if there's any difficult emotion in the mind, or if it's excitement that has pulled you away. The mind can be angry, it can be sleepy. The mind can be excited, We're not judging it. We're just seeing the mind state. The mind can be very calm and feel quite inspiring. Or it can be really collected and unified, and that's inspiring. If it's too much, just go back to breath and body. As the mind gets more collected and unified, it may feel more and more subtle, more rarefied, more at peace. Just notice that. And whether the mind's in turmoil or just kind of sluggy, kind of, you're just noticing, is this pleasant or unpleasant? As well as the quality of it itself. Because sometimes the mind cannot be in that refined state, but it actually feels just fine as a pleasant sensation. We're going to do our walking meditation now. And yesterday I had you walk and stepping into the Dhamma, that this was what you were doing, that you were stepping up your practice. And today I want to slightly change this. And each step you take, I'm going to ask you to say, and you can, you don't have to have it just with the steps. It could be like you're saying this. You're going to use a little mantra. I choose to be available to the Dhamma. I choose to be available to the Dhamma. And so you're saying this as you're walking. You can have them be separate. They can be together. I choose to be available to the Dhamma. This is like taking a trial run in your car. You're not committing. It's like you're thinking buying a new car and you're going out for a test drive. It's that feeling to it. But you're paying attention because you go, it'd be a big commitment if you bought that car or a house or whatever it is, apartment. So the same with, it's a big commitment to really step into the Dhamma. You can walk outside. We did all this yesterday. You can just follow other people if you're here today. It's the weather's good for walking right now, so that's good.